This time on Created Equal Season 3, Writers on Race. I talk with Colson Whitehead, the two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Nickel Boys and Underground Railroad.
It was founded on the principle,
we hold these truths to be self-evident,
that all men are created equal.
That all men are created equal.
Yeah. All men are created equal.
We talk about how the election of Donald Trump served as inspiration for him writing The Nickel Boys, and in turn, how Whitehead's book helped his readers understand the racial inequity that he sought to reveal and explore in the novel.
Well, you know, it's all one moment. If you're writing about police brutality or inequities in the justice system, in a book set in Jim Crow like Nickel Boys, or you're inspired by the election of Donald Trump, you're not being prescient, you're just describing it the way it is. And so, you know, we've never escaped our terrible situation with regards to race. And so if you write about racial inequities, they're always current because we never make any real progress.
Hmm. So Nickel Boys is set in the 1960s in Florida, and it tells the story of two boys who are at a reform school called Nickel Academy. That reformatory is actually based on the Florida School for Boys, where there are more than 50 unmarked graves that were found there in 2011. Tell us how you were attracted to this story and why you decided this was the time to tell it.
It was the summer of 2014, and we were capturing a lot of these police brutality incidents on videotape. And later that summer in August, they were excavating the site of this reform school, the Dozier School for Boys, and they found these unmarked graves. And it seemed that there's one place like this reform school, how many other police brutality events are we missing? And I was shocked. I never heard of Dozier. You know, it was covered in Florida papers a lot, but not nationally. And it seemed worthy of telling. The campus was segregated. There was a black part and a white part, and all the survivors who came forward once the school was closed to talk about their experiences 30 years, 20 years before were white. And I wondered what kind of story I could get out of the black part of campus, the untold part of campus.
Hmm. In the book, Elwood, who's the one of the main characters, of course, and the protagonist, gets caught up in a mistake. He does something that he's not supposed to do, but the rest of his life is patterned in a way that would suggest he was headed for great success. And that one mistake, of course, derails him and sends him to this reformatory, but also just absolutely ruins his life. And for me, reading that story just reminds me of the greater sort of message there that in America, if you're black, it doesn't matter all of the things that you do that you're supposed to do. We are one mistake away. We are one miscalculation away from absolute ruin and tragedy. And Elwood really captures that in a very, I think, searing and important way.
Well, yeah, you know, his mistake isn't much of a mistake. He's just hitchhiking with the wrong person. He has no idea that the car is stolen. And, of course, in the 60s, people hitchhiked all the time. And he's a goody-goody. He's a good student. He's actually taking college classes, even though he's in high school. And he's en route to the college campus when he hitchhikes and the car is stopped and it turns out to be stolen. So he's sent to this reform school through a miscarriage of justice. And, you know, I wanted to speak to the situation befalling so many young people of color. You know, we're just walking down the street, we're stopped by police, and then you're reaching for your wallet, they say you're going for a gun, and you get shot. You know, so many innocent encounters can escalate to something lethal just because you happen to leave 5 minutes later or 5 minutes early and encounter the wrong policeman. His situation, I think, speaks to so many people.
Yeah, yeah. The brutality that he experiences at the academy is quite vivid in the book. Talk about why you made the scenes of him encountering this violence so clear and so vivid, and what message, I guess, you're trying to send there?
Well, you know, with the Underground Railroad, you know, my previous novel, which is about slavery, there's a lot of brutality and the violence, because that's how the slave system was upheld. That's the fact of the story, and I want to be true to the slave experience. And so it's not Gone with the Wind, where, you know, a white lady is being self-actualized against a backdrop of slavery. It's like, oh, they're burning my house down. You know, they should burn your house down because you traffic in human flesh. So the brutality in that book was realistic, and it has to be realistic in the Nickel Boys, because I am talking about a real-life place and the brutality suffered by real-life people. But I don't actually, you know, I know a lot of the violence happens sort of off the page, so it's not described, because I'm not trying to exploit it. But in order to, you know, to describe the world accurately and realistically, I do have to, you know, show how they actually lived. And then I can get on to the human story between Elwood and his friend Turner. Once the facts are settled, I can get to their sort of philosophical argument about optimism and pessimism and how we can get along in a world that wants to destroy us.
Yeah. That relationship between Elwood and Turner, and that tension between the two of them, is a tension that plays out all the time in Black America. This idea of Elwood's, that if you do the things that you're supposed to do, even in circumstances of hardship, that somehow the institution, the faith in the institutions, will carry you through. Turner has a much more sort of dim view of all of that, and believes that the deck is inexorably stacked against Black people. Talk about that relationship and that tension in the larger culture.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Elwood, you know, seems to be the sort of larger-than-life person. He's so pure and has such a lofty idea of humanity. But he was inspired by real-life people like Dr. King. You know, he's in the early 60s, he's seen Dr. King and his cohort marching and sitting and boycotting and making change. And so he does have a model of how the system can be changed. And then Turner, he's an orphan, and that's why he's sent to this reform school. It was a warehouse for people who were delinquents, but also wards of the state who had nowhere else to go. So he believes he's, you know, a survivor. He's lived by his wits and doesn't believe that people change, that systems change. And you can't, you know, really live wholly in one camp or the other. You have to borrow from both. It's easy to be pessimistic because there's so much evidence that, you know, people are pretty terrible and the world's pretty terrible. But you also have to have hope. You know, I have children, and I have to hope that the world that they're growing up in is better than you know, the one I grew up in, the same way my parents and grandparents, who existed in a world of much more severe racial oppression, had to believe that I would grow up in a better place. And so you can't survive without that hope. And yet every day you're confronted with the evidence that undermines that that idea.
Yeah. There's also a sort of narrative device that you use in sort of making it clear that Elwood and Turner are not all that separate either, right? That they kind of are one, and the narrative twist that is revealed in the book really sort of cements the idea that they are much more connected in their ideals than they are separated by the tensions in the differences in their beliefs. Talk about how you've sort of pull that through in the book. Singularity.
You can't have one. You can't live in completely with one philosophy of how to be in the world. You need that mix. And so, I think most of us have our Elwood selves and our Turner selves, and sometimes one is winning out more than the other. But to live, you know, completely in an idealistic fashion and believe everything will work out, or to live in a completely pessimistic fashion that nothing will work out, is not sustainable. And so we do have to borrow from reality and also our more idealistic selves.
Mm, yeah. I want to talk about the torture building in the book at the Academy. It's nicknamed the Ice Cream Factory by the white boys who were there and The White House by the African-American boys. Can you talk about why you chose to make that distinction? It seems like it's saying something about the differences in the way that we experience things as Americans and the differences in the way that we interpret different experiences.
Sure. I mean, yeah, those are real life details. At the Dozier School, once, you know, there's an investigation and they said you can no longer beat the students, which seems perfectly reasonable. So they moved the beatings to a utility shed called the White House. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and both the white and black campuses call it the White House, but the white kids also call it the ice cream factory as a joke because you came out with bruises of every color. And this, you know, I like to make up details, but then some things you can't compete with. Obviously, the White House has so much different kinds of resonance that I had to keep that real life detail and let it work for the book. I was doing a talk last summer, and someone in the Q&A stood up and said, "You know, I wasn't at Dozier, but I was in another reform school, and we also call it the ice cream house there because of the same thing, the bruises that you came out with." And so this kind of grim survivor humor was coming up simultaneously in all sorts of different places. And, you know, the kind of joking that you do in order to get through the day and make the severity of the situation not so terrible happens everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. When we see Elwood in the future, in the book, he is not any longer at the reformatory. He is an adult trying to put his life back together and succeed. And then at the end, we learn that...
Well, let's just say, yeah, let's not talk too much about the ending.
Okay, okay, we don't want to spoil that, right? We want people to read the book. But it does seem... as though the experience at the academy should have eroded his faith and belief in the civil rights movement and all of these things. And yet he's still clinging to these things and believes in them. Talk about why he stays with
those. Well, yeah, if there's no hope, why go on? You know, I think I've written three books in a row that sort of address that question. You know, a zombie apocalypse book. If you don't mm-hmm. believe there's a place of safety, why do you keep on the struggle? And that was Zone 1 10 years ago. Underground Railroad, Cora the slave runs north, and she has to believe, even though she's never been off the plantation, that there's a place of safety, a place of freedom. And it's abstract, and there's no proof of it, but she runs anyway. And then with Elwood and Turner, they have to believe that that justice is possible, that you can make something of your life despite everything that the world throws your way, because if you don't, what's the point of going on? And so, you know, two-thirds of the book take place in 1963 and 64, which I chose because it's the height of the civil rights movement, but also the height of Jim Crow, and those two contradictory energies are fighting each other. And then that means a third of the book takes place as I follow Elwood in the 70s and 80s and 90s as he tries to make a life for himself. He's been put off track by this traumatic experience and has to find a way to make himself whole. You know, can he do it? So many of the Dozier boys don't make it. There's drug abuse and alcoholism, and they're never able to get over this trauma that's derailed them. And so it was important for me to narrate progress to a whole self. How do you come back from a traumatic event? How do you find a way to love and be loved?
Yeah, Colson, as I said earlier, I think you read this book and this story of Elwood, and again, it wins the Pulitzer Prize in May, and then very quickly after, we learn the story of George Floyd in Minneapolis, which lays bare in reality the kind of overreaction, the disproportionate reaction to blackness and black existence in this country. I mean, the similarities, the parallels across your work and reality right now are just so powerful. I wonder what reactions you get to this work from white people.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, some audiences, you know, see themselves in Cora, see themselves in Elwood and Turner, and in some audiences are surprised at how slavery worked or the capriciousness of Jim Crow. Early on, when the book came out, I did a reading, and in the novel, Elwood is stopped by the police, and then we cut to his first day at the institution, the Nickel Academy, the stand-in for Dozier. And there was a white lady in her 50s who came to the talk, and she said, you know, how come you didn't show the trial? Like, how come you skipped over that? Am I just being naive that there was any chance that he would get a fair trial? And I skipped it because, no, obviously not. you are being naive to think that a poor black 16-year-old is going to get anything but railroaded by a white judge in the Jim Crow Florida of 63. And so, you know, for me, it was an obvious artistic choice. But for this, you know, for this white lady, it causes some confusion because, like, there's really no way out. And no, by page 33 of the book, we know that many avenues of escape are closed down.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have more of my conversation.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
With Colson Whitehead. Colson, this summer, the WDET Book Club is reading Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, which is another text that we think helps illuminate some of the things that we're dealing with right now in American dialogue and American culture. There are, to me, a lot of similarities between Ellison's work and some of the themes that you have worked with over the nine books that you've published. But this concept of invisibility that he deals with, of course, with the nameless character in Invisible Man, reminds me very much of Elwood and Turner, and the concept of being seen, of trying to be seen, of not being able to be seen as a black person in America. I wonder if you can talk about Ellison and Invisible Man and how it connects to the work that you're doing today.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's a very important figure for me, and, you know, coming across his work in seventh grade, you know, it was very instructive. It was an English class and one of those books that has short stories. So it was go from Shirley Jackson's The Lottery to the first chapter of Invisible Man. They sort of excerpted the first chapter of the novel as a short story. And if you remember, you know, it's pretty bizarre. The black boys are wrestling on an electrified mat. There's a woman with a American flag on her chest, on her stomach, walking around. And it's very surreal, and which I found very attractive even when I was like 12 years old. But also I thought, you know, here's this weirdo black guy writing fiction. I'm a weirdo black guy. Maybe I can, you know, step up and get my own weird stories on the page. And then, of course, coming to the book, the full novel in college, you know, in the same semester with Toni Morrison, you know, it was just really energizing and inspiring to find different ways of talking about slavery, different ways of talking about being black in cities, black in America. You know, they're both, you know, such powerful talents and definitely inspired my generation and the previous generation of writers.
Yeah. One of the other, you've just kind of hinted at this, one of the other real connections I see between you and Ellison is that affinity for surreality. So many of your books really use that narrative tool to wonderful effect. Underground Railroad, of course, is the most recent to do that. Talk about how you see the power of that surreality to give different kinds of life or different dimension to real life issues, things like slavery or things like reformatory racial brutality in the 1960s?
Yeah, I mean, you know, surreality, absurdity, these are features of our daily life. And so they become a form of realism. You know, I grew up wanting to be a writer because, you know, before I read that section of Ellison, because of Marvel Comics and Stephen King and Ursula K. Le Guin, The Twilight Zone. So fantasy literature, horror, science fiction made me want to write. And then when I got older, I was attracted to writers that you know, were able to move between realism and fantasy very quickly and with much dexterity, like Gabriel Garcia Marquez. You know, Toni Morrison has a ghost in Beloved. And, of course, The Invisible Man's adventures have these very absurd moments. He's in a factory that makes white paint. His room is studded with a thousand-something light bulbs underground. And so accepting the fact that our lives are often a bit fantastical, I think is a great gift. And I learned that very early from reading writers who use fantasy. Mm.
Also, of course, you were honored with the Pulitzer Prize for The Nickel Boys in May. It is your second in a row, in fact, because you won for Underground Railroad as well. You're only the fourth author in American history to do that two times. I obviously, congratulations, but I would love to hear how that has sort of sat with you. I mean, it's a remarkable achievement.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy, but it's been a crazy year. You got an impeachment, quarantine, plague. The president can't walk down a ramp. I mean, I feel like life has gotten, you know, very strange the last 6 months, and so I put the Pulitzer in with that. You know, it's hard to step back sometimes and think, is this all really happening?
Yeah. So when you were here in Detroit at Marygrove College, I asked you then what you were working on after Underground Railroad, and you said that you had three books in your mind that you were sort of mulling and trying to choose between. And obviously you settled on The Nickel Boys. And I think you mentioned that one of them was about reformatory. But I'm also, I want to put the same question to you now. What are you thinking about, and what is maybe next?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that was a while ago. I was working on The Nickel Boys at that point, and I hadn't finished yet. I'm putting the final touches on a novel, a crime novel. It takes place in Harlem in the 60s. So, you know, I finished Nickel Boys 2 years ago, and I've had time to work since then, so I'm, you know, just polishing this new story and about to give it to my editor. So it's very different. It's not as heavy as the last two books, which is nice, and there's more room for jokes. And again, it's a crime novel set in New York City, so it was really fun to just walk around my hometown and go location scouting. Is this where the hero lives? Is this where his office is? And just, you know, try to imagine him and all these landmarks that I walk by every day.
Mm. I also wonder how much of yourself you see in these characters you create. Cora in The Underground Railroad, Elwood in The Nickel Boys. As an African-American, how much of this is your experience, or how much of your experience reflects what we see on the pages here?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, sometimes I'm in my books a lot, and my characters a lot, or the supporting characters a lot, and sometimes not at all. Cora, you know, has the least amount of me in her, which is probably why it's my most popular book. But in terms of The Nickel Boys, you know, I think Elwood and definitely speak to different parts of me. My brother recently passed away, and I was sort of processing that when I was writing the book, and we were very close. And so, you know, two boys who are very alike, are very different, who are so close. You know, I'm definitely, me and my brother were in that relationship in the book. And sometimes it's useful to draw upon your own life, and sometimes not useful at all. You try to do what's best for the book.
On the next episode, I talk with Carol Anderson, historian, educator, and author of the book, White Rage.
We are so focused in on the flames that we miss the kindling. We miss the policies, the kinds of policies that systematically undermine African-American citizenship rights and undermine the advancement that African-Americans have had. That's white rage. It's quiet. It's subtle. It's bureaucratic. It's legalistic.
Created Equal is a production of WDET, Detroit's NPR station. Our executive producer is Joan Cherry Isabella. Our producers are Jake Neer, Anna Marie Seisling, and Claire Brennan. Our sound engineers are Matt Trevethan and Rowan Neomisto. Our composer and senior editor is Sam Bobian. And our social media and digital assets are done by Maida Stange and Tony Brown. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson.